From Michigan Radio, I'm Cynthia Canty, and you're listening to Stateside. Today, she was for John Kasich. Now a Michigan GOP delegate is behind Donald Trump.
I was very disappointed in Governor Kasich when he didn't say to us as delegates, go out there and support your nominee.
Some recovering addicts turn away from AA and NA to find sobriety.
I don't mean to offend anyone that gets success from NA, but the meetings that I went to were filled with negativity.
A tribute to a pioneer in Michigan's LGBT rights battle.
He said, we have to use the time we are here on this planet to make the world a better place. We have to leave that dent.
And the Ring of Fire.
So we'll have a multi-day period, 4 or 5 days of at least 90 degrees and humid, and that really adds a lot of stress to people who are heat sensitive.
Welcome to Stateside for this Wednesday. I'm Cynthia Canty. What you should know about alternatives to AA and NA programs for those in recovery. Also today, civil rights activist Jeff Montgomery has passed away. His contributions to LGBT rights in Michigan later in the hour. But first, expect to hear the phrase build the wall repeated a lot during this week's Republican National Convention in Cleveland. But as Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports, it's that type of rhetoric that may cost the party some votes in Michigan.
Voting for the first time can be intimidating. So to make it a little easier, a small group of people gathered in a community center gymnasium on Saginaw's South Side recently to vote for their favorite Coney dog.
So there's 1, 2, 3 hot dogs, Coney dogs to choose from.
But this is more than just an experiment in hot dog democracy. It's about learning the process of voting.
When it's time to vote, I need you to have your ID with you, okay? If you don't have your ID, that's okay. There's a process for this, and there's importance of that's why that's happening, okay?
Dan Sosa is the Michigan State Vice President of the group Latino Leaders for the Enhancement of Advocacy and Development, or LEAD. They helped organize the hot dog voting workshop. Sosa admits Michigan's small Latino population has voted in even smaller numbers in the past. But they are working to change that this year with voter education, registration drives, and plans to get people to the polls. Sosa says the political rhetoric in the 2016 presidential campaign is motivating Latinos this year to get involved.
You know, we're not telling folks how to vote, but certainly for some of us, I think seeing the rhetoric in the media by some candidates, I guess I should say, has driven some of those efforts.
One phrase seems to irk many Latino voters the most.
We need to build that damn wall.
That's State Senator Joe Hune speaking at a conservative political meeting last month in Howell. Hune is not only a delegate to this week's Republican National Convention, he was also a member of the platform committee that last week in Cleveland voted to put building a wall on the southern border in the party's platform.
This is such a fundamental component of the Trump campaign, and it's I think it's a large, very populist issue, too, securing our border.
But while it's a message connecting with many white conservatives, it's leaving many Latinos feeling excluded. Saginaw Valley State University political scientist Jesse Donahue says efforts to get out the Latino vote may be most visible in southeast Michigan.
What isn't clear is how far down the ballot that impact is going to go, but it looks like they are going to have a fairly large impact this time.
Debbie Vasquez with LEAD says the August primary will be a dry run of sorts for the November general election. She says they plan on following up with Latino voters to see if they voted and ask them about any problems with election officials.
Did you vote? How was your experience? Because we're trying to collect that data so that we can give back to make sure, like I want to even give information to the people that run the election inspectors. If they're having a hard time there, our voters. I want to make sure that somebody knows about that so they can fix that problem.
Knowing that kind of information may play a very important role in November, especially if Michigan ends up being a swing state in November. The state's largely Democratic-leaning Latino voters could play a much bigger role in the outcome than they have in the past. I'm Steve Carmody.
It is the midway point for the Republican National Convention, and now you can peel away that word presumptive when you talk about Donald Trump, because after last night, he is the GOP presidential nominee. We've got a Michigan delegate with us now from Cleveland. Judy Schwalbach is the former mayor of Escanaba. She's representing the 1st Congressional District at the convention. Judy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Judy, before we talk about what's happening now, I want to go back to the primary season, which was long and contentious. And I know you did not support Donald Trump during that season. You supported John Kasich. Why was that?
Well, you know, I've been a fan of John Kasich for many years. I followed his career along, and I found him to be a real gentleman. And I thought he was one of those people that could tell us what we needed to hear, not what we wanted to hear. So I supported him in the nomination process in the primary because of that, and because there were 17 people running. I had to pick one of 17. And I firmly believed in John Kasich.
And yet last night, the Republican Party made it official, and Donald J. Trump is the nominee. Judy, what were your thoughts and feelings as all of that came together?
Well, you know, I would truly have loved to have seen John Kasich as part of that nomination process. But, you know, as in with elections, we're a country of majority rule, and I'm fully aware of that. In fact, the last primary season, I didn't vote for Mitt Romney, and I fully supported him as the nominee. And as Donald Trump has evolved and become a different kind of candidate, and my district fully supported him, I'm 100% behind him.
Well, help me go through. I really am interested in your thought process. Can you walk us through how it is you came to say, okay, because I guess my first question is, can you give your full support to Donald J. Trump?
Absolutely.
All right. So
absolutely. No problem.
Take us through then that thought process. How did you arrive there?
Well, as I said, you know, you go through the primary. There's an election. You vote for the person that you would like to be the nominee. If that person is the nominee, great. If not, you support the person of your party. Now, if it was a person that I truly couldn't get behind, I would have had a much more difficult decision. I didn't have a difficult decision. My decision was between Donald Trump and John Kasich. And I know they're polar opposites, but that was part of the reason why it was a tough decision, you know. If I'm going to send somebody in a negotiation, I don't want to send somebody in that plays kumbaya. But at the same time, this country needs a little healing. So one is John Kasich, one is Donald Trump. I could only get 50% in either one of them. And I think Donald Trump's going to do a great job for this country. I believe we need a change of direction, and I think he's going to take us there.
Judy, there is not much being said by most of the convention speakers about Donald Trump. In fact, I know last night Speaker Ryan mentioned his name exactly once during the speech. Can the Republican Party win the White House if its major leaders like Speaker Ryan can't even bring themselves to say the nominee's name?
Well, have you gone back and researched how many times other speakers have mentioned the presumptive nominee in their speeches? I think we're reading something into it that isn't there. I felt a real sense of getting behind. I've had other Kasich delegates come to me, Cruz and Rubio delegates, that said, it is not going to be Hillary, and we are going to work our buns off to make sure it's Donald Trump.
Senator Ted Cruz, we know, is speaking tonight. Would you like to hear him get up there and endorse Donald Trump?
I would very much like to, and I was very disappointed in Governor Kasich when he didn't say to us as delegates, go out there and support your nominee. I was disappointed in him over that. I hope I'm not disappointed in Ted Cruz tonight. And I would also encourage the nominee, and I had to take that little step back and say, okay, it's not presumptive nominee, the nominee, Donald Trump, tomorrow night, to rise above it and welcome all the Kasich people, including John Kasich.
Because, yeah, he's been pretty openly critical of Governor Kasich for taking a pass on being there. And let's talk about opening the tent door even wider, Judy. You know, last night we saw delegates chanting, lock her up, during Governor Christie's speech attacking Hillary Clinton. There's been so much about tearing into her. And when that happened, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona tweeted, and here was his tweet, Hillary Clinton now belongs in prison? Come on. We can make the case that she shouldn't be elected without jumping the shark. What did you think when that was happening, when you were there on the floor?
I was not chanting it. I think we take the information that we know to be true and we bring it to the American people, and I do not think they will vote for her. I don't believe that you win by that kind of rhetoric. That's just not my way of campaigning, and I was not chanting it. But there were a lot of people that were, and I think a lot of it is people get in the conventions and you just kind of get caught up in the moment, and there are people that truly believe that. That's okay. And I'm not saying that I wish they hadn't pressed charges against Hillary Clinton. Because I can guarantee you, if it was Judy Schwabach that had done that, we'd have a problem. When I was mayor, my city clerk told me, you know, you're using your private email. If you're FOIA'd, you have to give us your whole computer. I understood that. I'm quite sure Hillary Clinton understood it, and she had a lot more important things on her server. So people can come to the realization that she should have been charged, and lock her up is pretty much rhetoric. And I wouldn't have went there.
Judy, you're talking right now to thousands of people in Michigan who are listening to us, and certainly among those are people who are, you know, still trying to figure out what direction they want to go. What should they do in November? So make your pitch, Judy. Why should people vote GOP in November?
For my grandkids. I have four grandchildren, and I care very, very deeply about my children and my grandchildren. And this country needs to learn how to pay its bills, protect its borders, invite in legal immigrants. I'm a legal immigrant. Donald Trump believes in that. He's married to a legal immigrant. If Donald Trump is elected president, our Congress will work better, our Senate will work better, and best of all, most of all, the Supreme Court justices that will be appointed by this man will not be what we will get with Hillary Clinton. That's 30 years. So please, whatever you do, consider 30 years of the worst we can have. How do we get back from that? Donald Trump is running. He's going to get 4 years. If he does good, reelect him. If he doesn't, get somebody else in there. You got to go a different direction, Michigan. We need the jobs.
Judy Schwalbach, the former mayor of Escanaba. Judy is at the Republican National Convention now representing the 1st Congressional District. Judy, we want to thank you very much for taking time out of what is a busy schedule and talking with us today on Stateside.
Well, it's important, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Jeff Montgomery was one of Michigan's first gay rights activists. A personal tragedy drove him into becoming a first advocate for LGBT rights and to founding the Triangle Foundation, which later became Equality Michigan. Jeff Montgomery died this week in Detroit at age 63. Here with us is Jeff's friend and former staff member of the Triangle Foundation. He is now in New York City running the Tyler Clementi Foundation. Sean Kososki, we want to thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
Describe for us, from your view, Jeff's contribution to LGBT rights in Michigan and really nationally.
It's really hard to say in words the contributions that this man made, because he was respected nationally by gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender people and our allies in the civil rights space, in the anti-violence space. He was just deeply respected, and he would go to battle with far-right extremists who were trying to deny gay and lesbian people basic equality and safety in this country. And so he was feared by the right in many ways and respected and beloved by many on the left. And so he had a towering figure in the Detroit media and communications world, because his family had a long and respected place in the communications world at Chrysler and at the Detroit Times and as broadcasters themselves. And he played a very large role, of course, with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, with Save Orchestra Hall and the Detroit Thanksgiving Day Parade. So he just was a beloved figure in the area. And in the fight for human rights, not just LGBT rights, but for racial equality, immigration, all sorts of issues, he was always there. He was the guy who said, we should always be there when we're asked, not when it's safe. And so if some coalition needs our help on affirmative action or on women's reproductive rights, we should be there. Our movement needs them. We need to be with them. So he was just left a trail all over the country of positive relationships and goodwill.
Sean, tell us what happened in the 1980s in Jeff's life that really fired up this activism for him?
You know, I didn't know him until about 1995, 1996 myself. But from what I recall and what I know, he was in the community, of course, out and active. But there was a particular incident of his boyfriend, Michael, being murdered outside of a gay club in Detroit, and he had heard that the Detroit Police Department were just not going to investigate, that they had called this just another gay killing, so why bother? This infuriated him, so he worked with John Monahan and Dr. Henry Messer to create the Triangle Foundation, which at the time was a scrappy, small nonprofit of basically him not even drawing a salary for 2 years and, you know, building something from scratch into what was, by 2008, the fourth largest statewide gay rights group in the country. We were parallel to groups in Florida and California and New York, much larger states with much more money. He was growing this organization significantly because of his prowess as a strategist. So he really took us from nothing to a powerful political and civil rights engine in Michigan in that 14 or 15 years.
And what do you think it was, Sean, about Jeff Montgomery's personality and his style that made him such an effective leader in the movement?
I think he was angry. I think any activist out there is powered both by a love for what we can create for this world, but an anger about the injustice that happens. He had a personal story that drove him to activism, but he had a personal moral compass that drove him to see the intersections between race and gender and sex and economic justice. And he said, we have to use the time we are here on this planet to make the world a better place. We have to leave that dent. And so I think the thing that really motivated him was that he couldn't see injustice happening and not make a difference. He knew that one person with a pen and a biting wit could shape public opinion. He knew that one person with one idea could shape the law by introducing and passing a bill. I remember the first bill we worked on in the state legislature proactively in 1997, 1998 with State Representative Lynn Martinez to pass hate crime legislation. We got that bill through the legislature, nearly the entire legislature, on our first try. And every time you see something like that happen so easily, it powers you forward to say we can make a bigger difference. And so he stayed in the fight as long as he did when many executive directors burn out because he saw the victory after victory that we were able to deliver for people in Michigan. Mm.
I think of Triangle Start now over these more than two decades and thinking and about looking through the years and the fight for LGBT rights and the fact that you now work for the Tyler Clementi Foundation, which takes us right back to the tragic end of Tyler Clementi's life on September 22nd, 2010. Just recap for us, for people who need their memories prodded, about Tyler.
Well, Tyler Clementi was a young man who, at 18 years old, was just arriving as a freshman at Rutgers University in September of 2010, and his roommate, who didn't like the fact that Tyler was gay, decided to turn a camera on Tyler's bed while he had a date in his dorm room and secretly streamed a sexual act that Tyler was engaged in online and tweeted out to all of his friends to join the show, watch the show, and see what Tyler was doing. This humiliating act not only outed Tyler, but also just broadcast his personal business online. And he was in a downward spiral at that point and ended up going to the George Washington Bridge and jumping to his death. And dying by suicide like that, he was one of five or six high-profile bullying-related suicides that month, and it captured international attention. Tyler's was the story that was the most dramatic and captured the media attention. Organizations were formed out of that, not just the Tyler Clementi Foundation, but the It Gets Better Project and Spirit Day and StopBullying.gov from the government. Like, so much activity happened in the national consciousness after Tyler died. So homophobia, bullying, you know, we worked on the bullying bill in Michigan for 8 or 10 years. It finally passed Matt's law, but my background helping to introduce that legislation and Jeff's energy to try passing it after a dozen years really is some of the background for how I ended up at Tyler Clementi Foundation.
How would Jeff Montgomery want to be remembered?
Well, he was a fierce, sort of radical activist who shaped and molded me into who I am today. And I think he would want to be celebrated. I don't think he would want to be mourned. I think he would want people to use the occasion of his passing to vote, to register, to counter all of this vitriol that's happening in our country right now. I don't remember a time where our politic was so divisive and so mean, and how politicians and elected officials can say such horrible things about entire portions of our population and not suffer consequences that would have caused resignations just 10 years ago is amazing to me. And he would have been shocked and offended to know that we wouldn't use the occasion of his passing to highlight his activism to try to turn our national conversation toward love and acceptance and equality instead of division, because he always said that the language and the rhetoric and the culture what was fueling violence. And we see that now against immigrants and Muslims and Latin Americans here in this country. Jeff would want us to be highlighting that and doing something about it. And anyone who wants to do something to honor Jeff should absolutely make a donation to Equality Michigan. They are the organization that is his legacy, and they should absolutely do something to support that organization.
Sean Kosofsky, we want to thank you for sharing your thoughts and your memories and your feelings about your friend, about your mentor, Jeffrey Montgomery, who passed away in Detroit at age 63. Thank you so much for being with us, Sean.
Thank you.
If you like it hot, you're in luck. And if you can't stand a sweat, then crank up the air conditioning or head to that nice cool basement. Michigan's going to be so hot over the next few days, they're calling it the Ring of Fire. Meteorologist Jeff Masters of Weather Underground is here with us. Jeff, Ring of Fire sounds a little ominous. Just what is it?
What it is, it's a giant area of high pressure currently centered over the middle of the country that is going to shift slowly eastwards. And by Thursday and Friday, we're going to have our hottest weather of the entire summer, about 95 to maybe we could push 100 degrees in some areas of southern Michigan.
So break it down. What's Michigan in for over the next few days? And I'm wondering, is it the whole state or will some parts sizzle more than others?
Yeah, it depends on the cloud cover. I mean, now Thursday is going to be plenty hot and the humidity is really going to come up. You're going to notice a lot more moisture in the air, which makes it hard to sweat. And it's really going to feel like it's 100 degrees tomorrow, even though it's not going to quite be 100. So we'll probably get our first heat advisory of the year tomorrow. And that will be, you know, a warning for, you know, stay indoors in air conditioning, stay cool, don't overexert. But the really hot day is going to be Friday. It's going to be probably upper 90s most places in lower Michigan, a little bit cooler further to the north. And after that, it's going to cool off slightly for the weekend, still be in the 90s and still humid. So we'll have a multi-day period, 4 or 5 days of at least 90 degrees and humid. And that really adds a lot of stress to people who are heat sensitive.
And how about storm action?
Well, it's the art fair, so in Ann Arbor, you got to figure there's going to be a storm with the heat. And sure enough, Thursday, we're expecting an area of organized thunderstorms to develop over the UP in the morning. And it's going to do something unusual. That organized area of thunderstorms is expected to push due south. So as we go through the day, you'll see this big area of severe weather with possible large hail and strong damaging winds pushing southwards across the state and be in the Ann Arbor area Thursday night, maybe, you know, 8 p.m., something like that.
What is actually going on, Jeff, meteorologically speaking, when we say we have a heat wave? What's happening in the air at that time?
You're getting high pressure, which means clear skies, sinking air, not much in the way of storm action usually to cool you off. And when you have high pressure, that tends to cause heating of the atmosphere because you've got sinking air that heats and expands and causes everything to dry out. So it's pretty ordinary sort of thing. You get it a few times a year. Typically, the second week of July is the hottest week of the year in Michigan. So we're a little bit late this year with our hottest week, but not by a lot. July is always our hottest month.
Jeff, I was looking at your blog and you were kind of talking about could this be the hottest summer in U.S. history. I'm wondering that, or could this wind up being the hottest year in U.S. history?
It's a better chance of the hottest year in U.S. history because we're already third hottest year on record this year for the U.S. We did have the hottest June in U.S. history last month, and I think July is going to be top five. August is shaping up to be top 10 hottest, probably not top five hottest. So I don't think we're going to beat the Dust Bowl summer of 1936 for hottest summer on record, but probably a top five hottest summer. Not hard to do when the globe is experiencing its hottest year on record.
There you go. So we got to look at that. And finally, speaking on behalf of the not a fan of hot weather contingent, I got to ask you, when are we going to get a break?
Sunday night, we're going to get a little bit of a dry, cool front moving through. So the humidity is going to go down starting on Monday, still be in the upper 80s, and that's hot, but it's not going to feel quite as sticky as it does, it's going to for the next 4 days.
Dr. Jeff Masters, Weather Underground, thank you for breaking down the Ring of Fire for us.
Okay, Cynthia, stay cool.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
You knew we had to play that. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
This is Julia Child. Bon appetit.
Love that. Delicious.
Connecticut has the snickerdoodle as its state cookie, Florida's state pie, the key lime pie. The potato is the state food of, well, no surprise here, Idaho. Maryland state food, blue crabs. And Michigan state food, you ask? Well, keep asking. We don't have one. And that bothered MLive's Emily Bingham enough so that she put together a poll asking you what you think Michigan's signature food should be. And she's with us now. Emily Bingham, what tripped this in your mind?
Well, I am a big fan of all things Michigan, but I especially love cool facts about Michigan history, Michigan culture. And one day I was just down an internet wormhole and I happened to stumble upon the fact that we have a state fossil, which is the mastodon. And I thought, oh, state fossil. Well, what are the other state symbols? And, you know, the ones that you learn in grade school, like
the robin
exactly.
We both said it at the same time.
You know, or the apple blossom is our state flower. And I was going through them. And we have some really interesting ones, like we have a state soil, which is Kalkaska sand. Hmm. And I was looking, and I just assumed there would be a state food, because I'd heard about other states having state foods before. And I didn't see one. And then I did some more research and found that other states have state foods, they have state soft drinks, they have state desserts, and we had nothing. And it has always honestly kind of bothered me a little bit. And so I thought when I was thinking about stories I could do for MLive, I thought, let's do a reader poll and at least settle this in the public opinion.
See what people
once
think.
Once and for all, see what people think.
So you put it out there. What were some of the choices that you offered in the poll? I mean, it was pretty long.
I tried to give people a lot of options, and I tried to give people some options that might be educational. A lot of people commented that they thought it was ridiculous that I included soybeans on the list, which I knew wasn't going to win at all. But in fact, Michigan is one of the top producers of soybeans in the country. So I wanted it to not just be for fun, but maybe also kind of educational. I also included some other things like Superman ice cream, which is has a long history in Michigan. And in fact, many people say it was invented in Michigan, that it was invented by Stroh's in Detroit. Whitefish. I included whitefish because we're the Great Lakes state. Bumpy cake, which was the Saunders
That's
dessert.
Right.
So I tried to stay away from specific branding, but I did include things like the Boston Cooler,
which was Verner's.
Which was Verner's.
Yes, Verner's. Verner's and vanilla ice cream. You're talking about my favorite summer treat.
Of course, yeah. Of course. But yeah, all things that felt intrinsically Michigan to me.
All right. So, imaginary drum roll, the winner is?
By just the thinnest of margins, the Coney dog.
Okay.
And I have to say, for all the people who voted for the pasty, you were beat by one percentage point. Yep. The Coney dog got 17% of the vote and the pasty got 16% of the vote.
That was pretty close,
then. That was really close. I can tell you the top five. It was the Coney dog, the pasty, cherries, which I thought for sure might win, Superman ice cream, and morel mushrooms.
Very good. Yeah. Well, we know how people love that. So would you like to do something with this now and maybe tug on some sleeves in Lansing?
You know, I thought about it and then I looked into it and I'm going to leave that for somebody else to do. The last time Michigan adopted a new state symbol was 2002, which was the state fossil. And it sounds like the gentleman who undertook that effort, it took a lot of work. And I don't doubt that maybe there's somebody out there who wants to carry the torch, but I'll move on to other things now.
If you've got a job to do. Uh-huh. Very fun, though, Emily Bingham.
Of course.
A state food crusader and writer with MLive. Thank you so much for sharing this with us, Emily.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to finding a pathway to helping an addict to recovery, most people and most courts think of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. The popular view is that AA and NA, these 12-step programs, are the only ways to get and stay clean and sober. But there are other options like Smart Recovery, Life Ring, Buddhist Recovery. And for some, these alternatives can do what the 12-step programs can't. We'll continue now with our series, Minding Michigan, as we explore mental health issues. And with us now, Chris Odrosky, who works at Home of New Vision and Addiction Recovery Center. Chris is a recovering alcoholic, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Caitlin Darfler is here with us. She is recovering from heroin addiction. Caitlin, thanks for being here.
Yeah. Hi.
Chris, so you work at an addiction recovery agency, and you are in recovery 8 years sober?
I will have 8 years in October, correct.
Congratulations on that. What was it about AA, about Alcoholics Anonymous, that didn't work for you?
Every time I was introduced to 12-step meetings, and usually it was a nudge from the judge, as they say, it was because I had done something to where I was required to go. That's one barrier right there, is that I'm forced to go. And then initially it was the higher power issue.
You mean God? You're working
the God,
in the God thing?
Yeah, also known as the God thing.
The God thing. Okay.
And I had been agnostic and atheist most of my life, and that I struggled with that aspect of it immediately. And also the powerlessness word itself, I struggled with.
Talk about that powerlessness word.
Well, when you come into 12-step community, 12-step meetings, you're told that you're powerless over alcohol or whatever substance that you do. And sometimes that can get misinterpreted through the individuals in the program. The program itself says that we were powerless, and it says were instead of are. So over time, it took me a while to kind of focus on that. But then sometimes the individuals within the community, in my opinion, kind of take it too far. Like, you're powerless over everything. You're a powerless person.
So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm powerless.
Right.
So what can I do?
What can I do? I'm powerless.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that ties into the higher power thing, because for someone like myself that I believe to be a little more action-oriented, I enjoyed the action steps. Of the 12 steps, I did not enjoy the spiritual aspect of the program or the religious aspect of the program. So when you were saying things like, I'm powerless, I must give it to God. And sometimes for someone like me, it didn't work well.
That's setting up a friction that you don't need as you are working to your recovery.
Correct.
Caitlin, you're recovering from heroin addiction and clean more than how many days?
I think it's 122 today.
Oh, well, congratulations
on
that. What didn't work for you with Narcotics Anonymous meetings?
Oh, my gosh. Very similar story to Chris. I mean, the whole thing started with me being like an atheist and not really jiving with the whole higher power thing, because they tell you it can be anything when you go there. But to me, it really felt like a bait and switch. Like, the longer you're there, the more they expect you to like come to God and have like some sort of spiritual awakening. And they do talk about the spiritual awakening aspect of it. And for me, like, I tried so hard. I tried rewriting the steps in a way that made sense to me, or I could apply to my life somehow. But even like the language, you were powerless, I still to this day disagree with that, because I was the one that got myself sober. I was the one that took action while I was using to get into rehab. You know, no one forced me. I never had any record or problems with the court. So to me, again, it's like that action-oriented thing. I took the steps I needed. I understand where it comes from, because, when you're physically dependent on something, you can't really just stop without there being consequences. It's like having a gun to your head. You still have a choice.
As you have been through this process of seeking recovery, and it's a struggle, isn't it? Because you've been through, what, about 8 inpatient treatment programs? Tell us about
that. In about 2 years. So I started using in about 2013, like daily IV heroin use. And for about a year, there weren't really any consequences per se, other than, you know, being dope sick occasionally if I couldn't get drugs. But after that year, I realized like I needed to do something. It wasn't cool anymore. I didn't have that like junkie pride they talk about. I didn't feel like I could continue this lifestyle. I was either going to die or just be useless for the rest of my life. And so I went to my first inpatient rehab, stayed there the whole time, and I did really well for about 90 days. I was trying the whole NA thing and kind of experimenting with it, getting into it. And so much of it I saw, and I'm definitely biased, and I'll say that straight off. I don't mean to offend anyone that gets success from NA, but the meetings that I went to were filled with negativity, and I've been to meetings all over Metro Detroit, and there were certainly good meetings too, but so much of it was like how bad my day was, how bad my life is going, telling the same stories over and over
War
again.
War stories.
War stories, yeah, that's what they call it. And don't get me wrong, there are certainly people there that talk about useful things.
So it wasn't clicking. You go through this in and out of treatment programs. Mm-hmm. At what point and how did you hear about something that was an alternative?
Oh,
something different. What was that like?
I'm so angry it took so long. I didn't even hear it from anybody in any of the rehabs I was in. My friend, I found out a friend from a long time ago had gotten a DUI, and
she was, I guess, required through the courts to attend some sort of program. And she was in Kalamazoo, I believe. And they allowed her to do smart recovery online since there were no smart recovery meetings out there. And she explained to me, you know, it's science-based. And so I was like, oh, really? Let me check this out. And I was just like, wow, these people are actually here and working on things they can do to stay sober as opposed to just talking.
Chris, as you work with people who are struggling, recovering, and staying there, do you find often that people don't know that there are other options? Because I could just see how angry Caitlin's face was when she's like, I just had to wait so long. Is that a story you hear a lot?
Yes. I work with clients at Home of New Vision, and when I get around to telling them, usually it's one of the first things I say. That's part of my job, is to get them informed as quickly as possible once they become a client at Home of New Vision. I'm not a clinician. I try to stay away from that as much as possible. I like being a peer. I like being able to do different things. I like being able to research these pathways, which is what they've allowed me to do over the last couple years. Most people have no idea that there's any other options out there, or if they have heard, they're getting poor information.
As in?
As in, they believe smart recovery is a moderation program. They sometimes even think that's what the M stands for. Because they hear the word management, they think it might have something to do with moderation. And that's not the case. It's an abstinent-based program. All the programs that Home of New Vision promote, all the meetings that we encourage our clients to go to, are all abstinence-based. They might not all be faith-based or spiritual-based, but that's not the point. The point is clients go to treatment to find abstinence, an abstinence lifestyle, recovery. And through these multiple pathways, which includes the 12 steps, I want to say that too. Yeah. You can't have a multiple pathways program without the 12 steps. Just because it didn't work for Caitlin and I, we figured out a way for it to work for both of us. I heard Caitlin said this very similar thing to what I did. I focused heavily on the action steps and kind of left the spiritual stuff aside, because they say take what you need and leave the rest. And I took that quite literally. And we leave that option up for our clients too. While they're in treatment, they learn about these multiple pathways. And when they leave treatment, it's up to them to decide what pathway works best for them or any combination thereof. Because people are only going to be in treatment for so long.
Then they have to live their lives.
Then they have to go out into the world and be people like everybody else. And it's up to them to figure out what pathway works best for them.
I'm speaking with Chris Odrosky, who works at Home of New Vision, an addiction recovery agency. He is in recovery, 8 years sober, having dealt with alcoholism, and also talking with Caitlin Darfler, who is recovering from heroin addiction, over 100 days clean right now. For both of them, the traditional pathways of AA and NA, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, didn't work. And Caitlin, smart recovery did work for you. What was it and how does it work?
I make meetings when I can. We have a lot in Detroit, luckily.
And how do they differ? What's the meeting? What is it about that meeting that's working for you in a way that the NA meeting didn't?
If I could be funny for a second, we have acronyms and not isms. I like that. No, I just, there's actually tools we use. It's kind of set up like a class with a facilitator like Chris. We go over things that will actually help us.
Give me an idea of a tool that you've learned through this that you can say, yep, that has really helped me to be where I am right now, which is saying that over 100 days now since I've used.
Well, my favorite is probably the cost-benefit analysis, which is essentially a glorified pros and cons list. But we make sometimes we do it in class, like on a chalkboard or whatever. Well, not a chalkboard. Gosh, I'm so old. On a whiteboard. I mean, you can do it for anything, but the first one you usually do is about, like, your drug of choice and, like, the pros of using. You write that, like, on the left-hand column, and then the cons of using. And then on the bottom, the pros of stopping using, and then the cons of stopping using. And you go through, and if you do that on your own and you're really honest and open, writing it out is such a different experience. It was, like, a revelation for me. I'm just like, oh, and the best part is after you write out all those things, you go through and you mark which ones are short-term effects and which ones are long-term effects. It shows the balance. When you see it, that just short term, it's fleeting.
That short term, that the long term benefits of it's the work you need to do.
Yeah,
they're great. They're great to do at a meeting too.
For sure.
Once people kind of come out of their shell, it's odd sometimes when you tell a group of people, let's talk about the pros of using and drinking. And
people don't want to address it.
But when I say, don't worry, I will not let you leave just talking about that. Yeah. The surprise at the end or the aha moment is okay. Now look at these and see what are short-term benefits and what are long-term benefits.
And what's that slogan you were saying? Change
your thinking, change your behavior.
There you go.
when we get urges or cravings, we use kind of the thought as if we're being attacked by these urges or cravings. So the best thing to do is disarm the enemy. So one way of disarming the enemy is making it silly or giving it a voice, giving it something to personify the addictive voice, which is addictive voice is something that's used in a lot of non-12-step.
Yeah, rational recovery.
Rational recovery uses it as well. So the addictive voice is basically the voice that you hear in your head saying, hey, let's go have a drink or let's go use. Mm-hmm. To disarm that voice, one way, and again, it sounds silly, but it works, is to give it a funny voice.
Yeah. Mine's Veruca Salt from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She's like, I want drugs now! You know,
and you can laugh at it.
Exactly.
It takes the power away.
Yeah, it's not me. My thoughts are not me.
Gilbert Gottfried is another popular
one. That's a good one. So how does Gilbert Gottfried talk?
Nothing.
No, but I know what you're saying. Make it ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And as you just said, that's not me. So yeah. Caitlin's not saying that is what
exactly.
you're saying. Caitlin can make that go away.
It's just chemicals in your brain essentially telling you because you learn these habits. You learn that the drugs give you pleasure. So your brain tells you you need more of it, just like anything, like food or water. And
Chris, what else do you hear from the people that you're working with who say, you know what? This is working for me, and whatever the program may be, in a way that AA or NA doesn't.
People, first off, seem to appreciate just having the choice. Sure. Whether it works for them this time around or not, they really do appreciate the fact that there is a group of people, there is an agency, there's organizations out there that are trying to promote. And we're going up against, you know, we're not going up against mm-hmm. that, but as far as marketing goes, you know, the 12-step groups have been around for 80 years.
Which is probably why no one thinks of these newer alternatives.
When SMART's been around for over 20, LifeRing's been around for 10 or so years, and Refuge Recovery was the Buddhist meeting that you mentioned. They've been around for, I think, 10 plus years, if that. But I know SMART, because I took the training, I know for a fact that they've been around for 20 years. So it's hard to compete with that level of marketing. You just, everyone knows about 12 steps. 12 steps are in Hollywood TV shows and movies. I've never seen any other type of recovery other than a treatment center than 12 steps in any type of television show or movie. For a client to come up to us and say, just thank you for giving me these other options. When I can actually see someone engaging in these, they take what they need and they leave the rest from all the different meetings.
So there's no one size fits all. So it lets me tailor something to my personality, my addiction, my needs.
Yep. I still gain certain things from all the things that I've learned when I was in early recovery, which was primarily 12-step and outpatient treatment. I enjoyed my outpatient treatment sometimes more than my 12-step meetings, which I guess kind of led me on that pathway to a SMART recovery meeting because there's a lot of things that are in SMART recovery that are taken from the clinical world. When I had 3 or 4 years, I was really kind of burning out, I guess, on the 12 steps. And I enjoyed being in recovery, but I didn't know what else to do. I was kind of upset, like Caitlin, when I found out that there were other meetings. Yeah. I was also upset to find out that they were pretty far away.
Mm. There weren't too many.
And, you know, 10 years ago, the internet wasn't as available as it was now.
What do you think has to happen to make more people aware that there are other options? Not AA may work for you, NA may work for you, but if it's not, there are other options.
They need to get this stuff in treatment centers. I mean, honestly, because even my peer recovery coach, who I love to this day and still go to his meetings, he didn't even know what SMART recovery was. I'm like, how are these people not getting this information? I mean, I literally had a counselor there tell me that if I did not get involved in NA or the 12 steps, I was doomed to fail and would probably die. That was a counselor. That was someone with their college degree in this stuff.
So it sounds like
more training
and more awareness in the field itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There are groups called Recovery Community Organizations, or RCOs, and there's a local group in Washtenaw County called Washtenaw Recovery Advocacy Project. And they have done a lot of work. I'm a member of that group as well. They've done a lot of work on advocating for recovery. Mm. And we've done events where we've tried to promote these multiple pathways. RCOs work independently of treatment agencies and any other agency. It's a nonprofit group of people that are in recovery from addiction and friends and family of those. Either they've had someone that they've lost or they've friends and family of people that are success stories. And they all get together and they plan walks and rallies. But a lot of times I look at it, and I'm not just saying that with the Washtenaw group. I'm saying it with all the groups they're not directly tied to treatment centers, but they're connected because they're links. They mm-hmm. can help people get to treatment. A lot of times I feel that we're preaching to the converted.
Yeah.
And I know I'm an atheist using that term, which might be kind of funny. But I do believe that a lot of times we are preaching to the converted, and we need to cast a wider net and get to the people that don't know. So, I mean, being on this show is obviously very helpful. Mm-hmm. I've had the opportunity to speak at opioid awareness groups. I've talked to social workers at hospitals. I would love an opportunity to talk to doctors and judges as well, because they're also ones that really need to know that there are these other pathways. I've had the opportunity to go to the local hospitals through connections with the social work teams there. And when they have people that are in the hospital for having something to do with substance use, I'm able to go in there and just talk to them and let them know that these other options are there. Treatment is great too, but like I said earlier, you eventually have to leave treatment. Even if it's outpatient, you eventually will get discharged. If you're doing good,
yes. mm-hmm.
you will eventually get discharged. And you still need something, some sort of self-help.
Caitlin, where do you think you would be right now if you had not found Smart Recovery?
Probably in rehab again. I don't know. So much of what I've learned in Smart Recovery has helped me personally, because it's like cognitive behavioral therapy type stuff. So it's really working on yourself. But the thing this time that's really changed is last few times I was in Oakdale, I spent so much of that time, especially when we had to do 12-step stuff, like talking about Smart Recovery, telling the clients about it, telling my counselors about it, telling my peer recovery coach about it. Being able to actually like affect the system has been so satisfying. And I know that's like a tenet of the 12 steps, actually, is like giving back and service work. And actually with another SMART facilitator, we've gone back to Oakdale and done some SMART presentations. It's so gratifying to me.
Do you think you could see yourself doing what we're seeing Chris do?
That's the goal.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
You guys share really compelling stories, Chris Odrosky and Caitlin Darfler. We want to thank you so much for sharing this and spreading the word and giving people listening the idea that there could be another pathway.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside's engineer today was Bob Scon. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.